This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Kyo Masekela's 1968 number one hit, Grazin' in the Grass. Kyo Masekela came to the United States in 1960 to escape apartheid in South Africa. He made his name as a musician in the New York jazz scene in the 1960s, but never forgot where he came from. His persistent concern for justice took him to 1,000 benefit concerts, to marches and rallies, where he used his fame to work for change back home. From Rumble in the Jungle to Graceland and the music Serafina, he and his music tell the story of a continent and a country's struggle for recognition and freedom. 10 years after South Africa's first free election, Kyo Masekela writes about his life in a new book called Still Grazing, The Musical Journey of Kyo Masekela, which he co-wrote with D. Michael Cheers. If you have questions about music or politics or how they interacted during the struggle against apartheid, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Kyo Masekela joins us now here in Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for inviting me, Neil.
I have a question about the picture that you have on the cover of your new book, Still Grazing. It's a boy, a teenage boy, 12, 13?
I was 16 then.
16.
Yeah.
Leaping for joy. It's a wonderful picture. But in his hand, this boy holds a magical trumpet. Tell us about that trumpet.
Well, in 1954... I asked my chaplain. Well, my chaplain at my boarding school, where I'd always been in trouble with the authorities, and he knew my parents were community workers, and he said, "What would really make you happy?" His name was Bishop Trevor Huddleston, who was a very radical anti-apartheid activist, and. I had just seen a movie called Young Men with a Horn, which was the autobiography of Bix Beiderbecke. It was played by Kirk Douglas. And Harry James, who had one of the most beautiful trumpet tones, you know, played the soundtrack. And I had just seen that movie with my friend, and I said, "Father," I'd been a piano player since I'd been six, and I said, "Father, if I can just get a trumpet, I won't bother anybody anymore." And he sent me with a note to go and get a trumpet from the local music store, give this boy a second-hand trumpet. I only have £15 I can spare. And he got me a trumpet teacher. And I started playing the trumpet, but like in 1955, he was deported from South Africa, and on his way back home to England,
Reverend Huddleston.
Yeah, Trevor Huddleston met Louis Armstrong and told him about our band, because other boys had joined me and we formed a band. And Louis Armstrong said, "Well, I guess I can send him one of my horns." I tooted through, so he sent us his trumpet, and of course we were front page news for the rest of that year, and we were in the front pages of the Star and the Daily Mail and the Argus, which never had Africans on their covers before. And that introduced us to the music community.
You write that your parents were not exactly taken with your idea of becoming a musician. My father, you write, was especially lukewarm. The Batlokwa, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, people.
Batlokwa, yeah.
His family clan prided themselves on education and community service. Music to them was something that respectable people listened to, but that was only played by irresponsible, illiterate, drunken layabouts. sounds like your school was not the only place you got into trouble with the authorities.
Well, my family was not very happy, because I came from a family of very highly literate people, and they were all like nurses and social workers and school supervisors and inspectors and school teachers and headmasters. My father was a health inspector, chief health inspector of Alexander Township at that time. My mother was a head social worker. And I was the first person in the whole clan, in the history of the clan, who was not interested in any education, and I was a very, very good student, so they were really blown away. But they eventually became my biggest fans.
Interesting, though, that you the way you phrase that in your book. You write the clan of your father, his family clan, not your family clan, not our family clan, his.
Yeah. Well, because they were the first generation to come from, you know, when we got vanquished by the colonial settlements, we came from our lands that we were dispossessed of. And so we were forced into urban life. And in the urban life, I came up in a very cosmopolitan African township where by the time I was seven, I spoke seven languages, you know, whereas like my father's people were the first to come to the cities, and his father's people came, I mean, were the ones whose lands were dispossessed. So in South Africa today, my generation and generations after that don't take any notice of tribe. In fact, I think we're the only country in Africa that is anti-tribal, as far as like I'm from such and such a tribe, you know.
The music that you listened to and learned from growing up, were these was this off records and radio programs?
There was a thing called the gramophone.
Yes.
When I grew up, and when I was 3 years old, I finally like really zeroed into the gramophone, and I wanted to move into it and live with those people who were making music inside it. And that's where my fascination with music started, any kind of music, as long as it came out of there. I wanted to live in that village where those people... So I moved into that village as a very young child. And I still, like, look at music from that perspective. I'm unable to, like, categorize it. And I like music from all over the world, you know. And it's just like I might not be crazy about a song, but I find it difficult to criticize anything that has to do with music because it's obsessed me since I was a child.
When you were in high school, you were already playing gigs in various groups around in various places. Tell us about an...
Well, I was playing with the Huddleston Jazz Band.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there was another incident that you write about, the Benoni Riot. This was...
Well, that was our first, the very first gig that we played outside of school was Trevor Huddleston, Bishop Trevor Huddleston's farewell concert. Because one of the things that Huddleston started also was a foundation called Union Artists, which asked, sort of forced the record companies to pay royalties to African artists and put together shows. And artists really admired him very much. So when he was deported, there were two farewell concerts, and we played at the second one. But on that night, there was a gang fight, a hell of a gang fight in the hall where, like, this one gang came in because some kids from Orlando Township, which is now Soweto, had killed one of them the week before in another township, and they came to look for them, and they knew they were there, so they...
And you were
put
playing,
them aside.
Your band was playing, and were told to keep playing while 17 people were murdered.
Yeah, keep playing or die. Yeah, they needed like a soundtrack.
That's like from a movie. I mean, that's unreal.
Well, life in South Africa, especially then, was a movie. It was a non-stop movie. I come from a very, very... When people are accosted on a daily basis, you know, when people like draconianly attacked with violence, they become violent themselves because they want outlets, and usually the outlets are each other and themselves. And then if you go to any troubled community or where there's like friction and there's like a confrontation and war, you find that among themselves the people are very cruel to each other. It's the frustration, I guess, of being under like violence. Violence begets violence. And I grew up in a very, very violent country where we had 300 years of war. So life is just now beginning to have value, and it's taking us a long time. But when the colonials came, they came for war, and they fought us for 300 years. So by the time I grew up, death was, I mean, like, I think that you might have read somewhere where, like, nine-year-olds, when I was a kid, nine-year-olds were in gangs and stabbed each other to death. And I think that it happens in many neighborhoods here in America.
Not unknown. Not unknown. Yeah. If you'd like to join our conversation with Hugh Masekela, our telephone number again is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll begin with Robert, who's on the line with us from Memphis, Tennessee. Robert?
Hello, yes.
Hi, you're on the air. Could you turn the radio down, please?
I'm pretty far away from it. Is it actually too loud?
We'll try to live with it, Robert.
Right.
Go ahead,
half
if you
a
will.
Room away. Well, I wanted to say that it was an honor to talk to Hugh Masekela. Your sister was just here in Memphis last week, the ambassador.
There's a delay.
My apologies.
No, there's not a delay. There was
turn it down. My apologies.
No, we
wanted to ask
had a
about
technical problem on this end. Can you hear this now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, good.
Okay.
Hello, Robert.
I wanted to ask about your music. The introduction to the show talked about Grazing in the Grass, and while that may have been one of the more commercial successes, one of the things that I've held close to my heart for many, many years was your first album, or as I know it, the first album, The Americanization of Ooga Booga. And then your music through the years, compositions like Stimella. I'd like to hear you tell me some of the work you've done that has been most meaningful to you in terms of someone whose both music and politics have stayed alive and been strong for so many years.
Well, first of all, I don't consider it my music. I found it here. I was born naked. I didn't bring anything. The album, Americanization of Ooga Booga, you talked about, was actually my fourth album. I started recording in South Africa, where I was in a group called the Jazz Epistle with the great Abdullah Ibrahim and Kipi Mwekezi and others. And then I did two more albums in the States before Ooga Booga, which was the first one to connect. I've done over 40 albums since then, you know, and... there's some that I'm proud of and some that I'm very ashamed of that some people love, you know. So if you multiply 40 by 12 tracks, that's a lot of music. And you live with an album for the time that you're doing it for, depending on, some people do it for 6 months, some people for a month. That's my average, is I've conceived it, and then for a month you go between recording and mixing and the pictures and all that. And by the time you're through with it, Robert, you don't want to hear it anymore. You're tired of it.
Well, on that spectrum from loving it to being ashamed of it, where does the Americanization of Ooga Booga fit?
No, the Americanization of Ooga Booga is one of my proudest albums because it's the one that introduced me to America. Mm. I have a few other albums, Promise of a Future, which had Grazing in the Grass in it. The album before Promise of a Future was called Live and Well at the Whiskey A Go Go, and we had a cover of the Fifth Dimension's Up, Up and Away, which went up to number 33 in the charts. I did one of my all-time favorites after Promise of a Future called Masekela, which was all like protest, very radically protest music, which the distributors sent back.
Robert, thanks very much for the call. I guess Robert has gone back to listening to the radio. He did mention one song, Stimella, Coltrane, from 1974. We'll listen to that on the way out, and we'll be back after a short break. If you have questions for Hugh Masekela, our telephone number is 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with South African jazz musician Hugh Masekela about his life and about his new autobiography called Still Grazin', The Musical Journey of Hugh Masekela. Of course, you're invited to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or send us email, TOTN at NPR.org. And one of the songs you were talking about, some of the music of which you were most proud just before the break, and one of the songs that you really had to know has a lasting resonance and influence, will be remembered for a very long time, is a song called Bring Him Back Home, which became the anthem for Nelson Mandela.
Bring back Nelson Mandela.
Masekela, how did that song come about?
That song was sent to me by Nelson Mandela. In 1985, I was living in Botswana, and I just started, I've been involved in initiating the Botswana International School of Music and recording studios as well there. And somehow, he had been in jail for more than 20 years, but he knew everything I was doing. And he knew my family, and his wife would report to him when she went to see him what we were all doing. And he got all this news from her and sent me a birthday card on April the 4th, 1985, congratulating me and encouraging me to go on with what I was doing. And I was really blown away. It brought tears to my eyes that here's a man who hasn't been outside for over 20 years, encouraging me, who's a free person. And this song just came to me. It's just like the song Stimela. Mm-hmm. I was just sitting there and I thought about my childhood and the miners. And the song came to me. And I think that songs like that, you don't compose. Actually, songs that become very popular with people, I don't think you compose. I think they're sent to you. Hmm. Your soul just happens to be in the right frame of being at the time, and it's ready to receive something. And I think that's how most creativity comes, but that's how it happened.
Nelson Mandela, of course, was the father of the nation, living under terrible conditions on Robben Island. And you were at that time, I guess, living in West Africa, but traveling around, as you say, a free man. You were fighting the fight from the outside, but did it feel bad at times not to be in South Africa participating?
It felt bad to leave South Africa when I did leave, because I didn't really want to leave. I left South Africa, contrary to what was said earlier, because I couldn't get the kind of musical education I wanted in South Africa, even if I had been white. So I hustled. And with the help of Trevor Huddleston, I was able to leave South Africa. And later on, I came to Manhattan School of Music here with the help of Miriam Makeba and Harry Belafonte.
We have a question from an email just on that point. This from Dean Zimmerman, and a Minneapolis City Council member. Please talk about your connections to Harry Belafonte and Miriam Makeba, especially in regard to your music being introduced to a broader American audience.
Zimmerman from Minneapolis. Is he a cousin of Bob Dylan?
He could be. He could be.
Yeah, and as I said, Miriam Makeba made it possible for me to come to school, paid my fees, brought my first new trumpet because my Louis Armstrong trumpet was too old, and introduced me to Harry Belafonte, and together they sent me to Manhattan School of Music. I was really fortunate, right, throughout all my life, from Trevor Huddleston all the way through Belafonte and Dizzy Gillespie and Louis Armstrong and Miles Davis. Somebody was always helping me, and I had to vindicate their belief in me. And fortunately, I got to the point where I'm sitting with you here today. But one time, when I finished at Manhattan School of Music, I was very eager to go back home to go and teach and impart what I had learned. And Belafonte set me down and said to me, "Hugh, nobody knows you. You know, nobody knows you. And you're going to go down there, and with a mouth like yours, you're going to get into trouble and be thrown in jail and probably be killed. Why don't you stay here and make a name for yourself?" And I said, "Harry, how can I know that I'm going to make a name?" He said, "Well, we can't give you everything, you know, but like we're here to support you. But that's what you should try for, because then when you have a name, the media will be keen to talk to you, and you can tell the world about your country at that time. And of course, that happened, and thanks to his insistence. Otherwise, I don't know where I could have ended up. But a few of us lived in South Africa vicariously. Our spirit was there, and only our bodies were away. And we never thought that we would be able to go back to South Africa. So having been enabled to go back to South Africa is not only gravy in our lives, but it gives us a position. It gives us the opportunity to be able to initiate the rollback of those things that were taken away from us: our self-esteem, our lands, our tradition. I mean, apartheid spent billions of dollars on destroying our culture, impoverishing us, and like making us lose our self-esteem. And that is a very, very important thing for us to regain. And it is my obsession. I'm not the only one who is like that. But it's going to take a long time for us to even get into that mode, because, first of all, that has to be refinanced itself. And secondly, South Africa was isolated for a very long time. So those things that we're deprived of from the outside world seem very attractive to many people now. So like things Eurocentric or American are still very attractive, even to people who are at establishment level. And now that we've been accepted by the world. But my biggest obsession is that I didn't go to South Africa just to like enjoy freedom, but to join in the initiative to bring back our self-esteem, our pride, and the things that were taken away from us. In a friendly way, of course.
Let's get some more listeners involved in the conversation. Richard is with us from South Bend, Indiana.
Yes, Mr. Masekela.
Hello, Richard.
I'm a big fan of your music, and I was wondering, do you see any parallels between the music that you grew up around, the more anti-apartheid, politically charged music, and hip-hop music in America today?
Well, I didn't grow up around anti-apartheid music. I think like apartheid grew into our music.
Yeah.
You know, we always had music. We had war chants, because as I was saying to Neil earlier on, we had 300 years of war. You know, this is our first, after 350 years, this is our first 10 years of peace. And I don't see any parallels, because most of the hip-hop music I've seen is about booty. You know, there's maybe like a few instances, but most of it is, you know, I see like very underdressed women.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Pirate Treasure.
And there has been, of course, people in hip-hop who have like talked about social consciousness. But from what I've seen, it's mostly about wealth.
I wonder, what do your kids listen to?
My kids listen to everything. They listen to hip-hop, too. I listen to hip-hop, too. And I perform and record with a lot of kids. In South Africa, there's a music called Kwaito, which is the parallel of hip-hop, although their music is more socially conscious, you know, because that is the feature. So when I was here as an artist in the late 60s, I remember I was on tour with Marvin Gaye, you know, and he said to me, he called everybody Husky, he would have called you Nielski, and he said, Husky, I really like envy the fact that you don't sing love songs and you sing songs about relevant social matters and about your country. I said, well, Marvin, anybody can do it. You can do it too. He said, well, like in our record company, you know, they don't even think about that. I said, well, it's not about them. It's about what you want to do. And of course, later on, he did What's Going On.
Mm-hmm.
And
a few songs about pirate treasure, though.
Yeah, pirate treasure.
Yeah, booty.
Okay, booty. And, he was the champion of, like, a pirate treasure songs, but in it there was also music.
There was beautiful music.
And he had what was probably the most beautiful male popular voice that ever existed in this world. And he was a person of great compassion, too, even when he sang about pirate treasure. There was a certain admiration about it. And I don't want to, like, rank hip-hop, you know, I admire all music, but sometimes the content is, like, irrelevant to our problems.
Richard, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you so much.
A little bit later in your career, you came back to the U.S. to tour with Paul Simon on his Graceland album tour. It was it helped bring African music to world attention. I think that's when Ladysmith Black Mambazo certainly became world famous, already famous in South Africa.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of criticism thrown at Paul Simon in that regard. What did you think of it? You were a participant in the tour.
Well, I thought it was a waste of time because Paul Simon had sold 10 million records by that time. And we did a 2.5-year world tour, and all the shows were sold out. And the people who were picketing outside would be like maybe 12 to 20 people. I will go straight to the chase. When Mandela was out of jail in 1991, he invited Paul to South Africa. And at Paul's reception, the people who were pushing us out of the way to get him to Mandela were the very same people who were in those picket lines. And I'm just trying to show you how fickle people were, people can be. And also...
Well, the allegation was that he was ripping off African music for his own benefit.
Well, Michael McLaren, the year before, had done Double Dutch in South Africa, which was a big smash, and nobody said anything about that, and he didn't pay anything, any royalties. Paul Simon not only brought the musicians, most of the musicians that he recorded with, but also co-wrote songs with them, and they still get royalties today. So I think that it was... The media sometimes will follow a story just because it's going to sell copy. And I told them all that as soon as there's a more interesting story, they'll disappear. And they did, you know. But I even had disagreements with Trevor Huddleston, Father Huddleston then, because mm-hmm. he was the head and he had spearheaded the anti-apartheid movement.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he was pushing for was for South African musicians to be banned from playing outside. And I said, but how can you do that? They are already deprived in South Africa. They are bringing the music of their people and bringing awareness to people outside about what was happening in South Africa. And by the way, Graceland was a very, very radical anti-apartheid show. And he said, well... Creature, I used to call everybody, well, Creature, you know, we can't make any exceptions. Well, sometimes people and their passions about being anti-something can sometimes go overboard and be disadvantageous to that very thing that they're trying to help.
We're speaking with Hugh Masekela. His new book is called Still Grazing, The Musical Journey of Hugh Masekela. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we'll talk now with Ron, and Ron's with us from New York City.
Yes, indeed. Mr. Masekela, we met once in the kitchen of Bernie Drayton in Brooklyn.
Okay, Ron, let's cut to the chase.
I'll cut to the chase. You know Bernard Drayton.
Yeah, I know him very well, yeah.
And we were there, and I remember Charlie lending you a flugelhorn.
Right.
And as you well know, Charlie's a monster musician in his own right. And my great memory is when Charlie was about maybe 2 feet tall, I went to visit Bernard and Izzy in Brooklyn. And there was Charlie on a summer's day standing up in ecstasy, triangulated between Bernard's big speakers with two drumsticks in his hand. And I said, hey, Charlie. And he would just had this grin on his face, and he kept saying, Hugh Masekela, Hugh Masekela.
Where's Charlie now?
Well, he's living here in the city and producing and, you know, still playing.
Okay, well, give him and Bernard my love. I have very, very fond memories of them.
I will.
That raises a question. You started with a trumpet, indeed, Louis Armstrong's trumpet. When did you switch to flugelhorn and why?
I switched to flugelhorn over 35 years ago when I bought an album called The Musings of Miles. And on that album, I think it's one of the very few where Miles Davis played the flugelhorn.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just this big, beautiful sound. It was just a big, round, a thick, burnished tone. I didn't want to play the trumpet again, and I haven't played it since. I play a little cornet on the side.
Mm-hmm. Well, Louis Armstrong strutted on the cornet as well.
Right.
Yeah. Let's talk now with Saba, who's with us from McDonough, Georgia.
Hey, good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hello,
good afternoon,
Saba.
I am a fellow African. I was born in Eritrea. And my question has to do with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa.
Yes.
In light of what's going on currently in the Iraqi war, considering that the United States goes into Fallujah to avenge the murder of the four American mercenaries that went in there, I'm wondering, you as an African, who you just said that you've endured 300 years of oppression, murder, and so on, how I don't understand how you come to the conclusion that those people that were murdered, that were black people that were murdered in South Africa, don't deserve the same kind of revenge or vengeance that, you know, white Americans or white people in general seem to want for their own victims.
Well, the first thing I can tell you is that we don't want our country to be like Iraq. We're not involved and we're not interested in vengeance. I think what we're interested in is turning Africa around and making it the joyful continent that it could be. We have the resources to do that. You coming from Eritrea know what the conflict between Eritrea and Ethiopia has brought to the people of that area. And it's usually people at the top telling like millions of people to fight each other. I think that's a very unfair thing to do. And we're not going to subject our people to that kind of madness.
Hugh Masekela, his new book is Still Grazing, The Musical Journey of Hugh Masekela. When we come back, we're going to be joined by one of his relatives who's gone on to some success in the diplomatic world, his sister, Barbara Masekela, South Africa's ambassador to the United States. Again, if you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, TOTN at NPR.org. And while we're waiting for the break, we can do that while listening to Freedom is Coming Tomorrow from Sarafina, written by Hugh Masekela. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, Ira Flatow is here with Science Friday. He'll round up the latest news in science and technology, from an update on electronic voting to an experimental drug that reverses obesity in mice. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Today, we're talking with South African jazz musician Hugh Masekela. To join the conversation, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And joining us now is someone else who played a prominent role in the fight against apartheid. Ambassador Barbara Masekela is South Africa's ambassador to the United States and also Hugh Masekela's sister. She joins us now in Studio 3A, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've been hearing an awful lot about your brother's life. Meantime, of course, you had a life of some success on your own, but your brother's becoming world famous, and what was that like for you?
It was wonderful. It opened up a whole world for me. And because I lived so closely with him, and we're a very close friend, and I'm a fan of his and his greatest critic, I was never a fan of other artists, because I knew that you had to separate them from their music. And I'm so lucky that he's the one artist who I can also be close with, because we have got, blood relations.
he has to answer the phone when you call.
Absolutely.
In many struggles, there are always people who are in the country and others who are outside. We asked Hugh about this just a moment ago, but I wonder, has it ever become an issue that Hugh Masekela was not there during the struggle against apartheid, that he was outside?
I think that for South Africans, we never had that inside and outside division. We always felt that whatever we did sprang from the people inside the country and that we were a part of them. And I think if you hear Hugh's music, you know that his music did not spring from outside South Africa, but that its inspiration and the vision is a South African one that is closely linked to the struggles and the, aims of the people, the objectives of the people of South Africa.
Let's get some more callers involved in the conversation. Peter joins us from South Bend, Indiana.
I'm delighted to be able to make contact with you, Masekela. Again, we met briefly in the mid-80s when he was part of a wonderful event at the University of Notre Dame with Miriam Makeba, part of a whole process of getting the university to divest from South Africa. The question I want to ask you is whether he believes that the Freedom Charter, which was signed by the ANC and other groups in 1955, is still relevant to the future of South Africa. And the reason I ask that is because the Freedom Charter had a vision not only of equality before the law for all South Africans, but a vision of a more equal society in which the gap between the rich and the poor would be closed. And what I suggest we have in South Africa at the moment is still an enormous gap. The wreckage of apartheid still has to be swept away. And the gap now includes a black capitalist elite and a white capitalist elite, and real poverty, even increasing poverty for the lower half. So the relevance of the Freedom Charter to the future, what political forces may bring it into effect, if he believes it's relevant.
We'll ask both Masekela for a response, but Hugh first.
Well, quickly, and I keep saying this, people think South Africa is supposed to be a miracle where we vote and we go into the sunset singing Heidi High, Heidi Ho, and everything that was planned or dreamt for South Africa happens right then. But it's a very, very long process to change a country. And I think that the United States, which is one of the richest countries in the world, has the same disparities, and it has been free for 200 years. But I'm going to let my sister Barbara answer that question even more clearly, because it's an area that she has to deal with all the time.
Well, very briefly, I think that, it's amazing how people are very selective about globalization. The fact is that all societies have, become one under globalization, and there are certain conditions that inhere in being a citizen of the world and participating in the world economy that affect all countries, that is South Africa included. In other words, we cannot go and take all the wealth from everybody and start dividing it up. And at any rate, as my brother has said, poverty is a problem all over the world, poverty and unemployment. And this is the challenge that faces everybody. We don't like it, but we are subject to certain regulations that demand that we don't have public debts, that we pay certain things, that we belong to certain organizations, that we don't steal other people's patents. And this is supposed to, it applies equally to South Africa as it does. So we cannot do overnight what we would really like to do for the people of South Africa. And we are very fortunate because the people of South Africa have confidence that slowly and in time things are being added and life has changed in South Africa dramatically. We have changed the economy of South Africa around. We have no public debt. We have increased pensions. We have introduced children's grants for black people. We've built 1.6 million houses. We've provided 9 million more people with water. Our education system has the highest budget, is the highest budget item, and so on and so forth. And so I think people should really be reasonable.
Peter, thanks very much.
Well, thank you. Superb answer.
Thank you. Why did I say thank you? I didn't make it. Anyway. Ambassador, I wanted to read you some of the same quote I read also earlier to Hugh Masekela. He talked about his father being especially lukewarm toward the idea of his playing music. The family clan prided themselves on education and community service. Music to them was something that respectable people listened to, but that was only played by irresponsible, illiterate, drunken layabouts. Well, in a way, after reading some of your book, Hugh Masekela, I think there is some... there might be some truth to that. I mean, there was some irresponsibility in your life, and there was some exuberance in your life as well. But at the same time, did he not also pride himself on education and community service in a way, do you think?
Who, Hugh?
Yeah, him, over there.
I think that Hugh's musical career has been one of service. He has certainly played a very important role in letting people all over the world know about apartheid, and through him and his music and other South African musicians like Miriam Makeba, they really brought the question of South Africa, the issue of South Africa, to the international public. But I think also Hugh has played a role in the civil rights struggle here in this country. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of benefits. Always did a lot of benefits, and those things are often forgotten as soon as they are over. And it's very interesting, even for us, for the struggle in South Africa, it is artists who really helped to bring South Africa to the fore, and they are the ones who supported people like Harry Belafonte. He's played an immense role in conscientizing people about South Africa, and many, many other artists have. I mean, during the struggle against apartheid, there was a group called Artists Against Apartheid all over the world, painters, writers, musicians. And I think that if you quantify it, you would find that there are as many, quote, irresponsible ministers of religion, teachers, lawyers, movie stars. I think proportionately it works out. It's just that artists are much, much more intense about their expression. And they're also much more in the public eye.
Ambassador Barbara Masekela, the representative of South Africa here in the United States. We're also speaking with her brother, Hugh Masekela, about his new book, Still Grazin'. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And an email question from Anna Kanarek. I hope I'm getting that straight. An ex-South African now living in Boston,
oh,
she
please.
Says. In the movie Amandla, you spoke so movingly about sitting in Central Park and talking out loud to yourself in Zulu, I think. You then decided it was time to go home. Please tell us about that.
I don't think that it happened that in a simplistic thing. I was speaking Zulu to myself 29 years before I went back home.
Mm-hmm.
But what I pointed out to you was that we were overseas. We were away from home physically, but spiritually we never left. And I think it is that very thing that made me like be able to be one to speak to myself in my native language, because I wanted to be very badly home. Another thing I wanted to correct is that for maybe the last 14 years, Barbara ceased to be a Hugh's sister. I am now Barbara's brother.
And I bet she never lets you forget it.
Quite the contrary. Like you said, we're very, very close.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Melanie, who's with us from Bullhead City, Arizona.
Oh, Hugh Masekela.
Yay!
I'm one of the big mamas still in the ghetto out here in Arizona, and saw you many years ago with Heads of Lay Sound and that in Berkeley. And,
oh, my God.
Did not know all of this political activism, but I'm an activist out here, and so happy to know you're still around, and I wish you'd come to Arizona and so I could listen to you some more for real. And congratulations on your efforts in your life and your sister, too. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
And I love your music.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Much.
Right. What's up next for you, Hugh Masekela? What are you working on now?
Well, I am on a tour of the United States, and on the 29th of, I'm doing all the festivals. This weekend we're playing a commemoration again and a tribute to the people of South Africa, mm-hmm. and to the people who helped us here in America. And it's put on again with the help of our embassy at the Kennedy Center. And I've brought three guest singers from South Africa, some of our best, Vusi Mahlasela, Jabu Kanyile, and Vusi Mhlonga, and also one of our greatest dance companies, Mopatong. Moving into dance, and it's going to be a wonderful concert. If you get a chance, you have to come out. Then I'm doing festivals all over America, and then I go to Europe, and I tour Europe with Jazz Jamaica All-Stars, and I come back here, and of course there's the book promotion. But central to my life in the future, like I said, is like the revival and the renaissance of the culture of our people, to try and reinvent all that was destroyed by apartheid in our culture and our self-esteem is most important to all of us.
Let's see if we can get one more caller in before we have to go. Elka is with us from Modesto, California.
Hello. I've enjoyed listening to this program, and your music just means so much to me growing up. Now, my question was, I had the opportunity to meet Desmond Tutu at my uncle's funeral last May, and in Aruba, and in meeting with him and other South Africans, there seems to be a deep spirituality that I've noticed in many South Africans, and I was wondering if my impression is correct, and how has that influenced your music?
We always seem to get the deep spirituality questions with a minute to go, but go ahead, please.
Well, we're a deeply spiritual, not necessarily religious, but a deeply spiritual nation, and I think that is the thing that has helped to sustain our resilience. And any celebrity that you meet from South Africa, whether it's Desmond Tutu, myself, my sister, Nelson Mandela, we're not self-made. If it wasn't for the people of our nation, we wouldn't be who we are. So anybody that you see from South Africa or seems world famous is a symbol, but it's just a symbol of the people of South Africa, because yes, they made him or her.
I've also noticed that too in other South, in just people that I've met that are from South Africa, and it's quite inspirational and moving.
Elka, thank you very much for the call.
You're welcome, and I always enjoy your show, Neil. Thank you so much for providing it.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
We're out of time, so let us thank Ambassador Barbara Masekela for taking time out of her busy day to join us and put up with her brother some more. We appreciate it very much.
You're welcome.
And Hugh Masekela, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you for putting up with me, Neil.
Hugh Masekela's new book is Still Grazin', The Musical Journey of Hugh Masekela. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.